Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Genesis chapter 8 and 9 today, which primarily deals with the aftermath of the flood, Noah and his family and what they did. Let's begin in chapter 8 then, where it says, "But God remembered Noah." Now remember that the word God is Elohim. We're going to run across the term Yahweh here in verse 21. There's been much discussion in recent years about source criticism for the Pentateuch. It's known as the JEDP theory of source criticism. I really have tremendous problems with that. I think a good book for you to look into on that would be Josh McDowell's Evidence That Demands a Verdict, Volume 2. The word Elohim, the rabbis say, speaks of God as creator and God in justice. But the term Yahweh, or YHWH, which is the Hebrew verb to be, from Exodus 3:14, the patriarchs didn't call him that. These folks, apparently, in Genesis, he was known as Elohim. The patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, called him El Shaddai. And not until Moses was he called by the special covenant term Yahweh. The rabbis say it refers to God as Redeemer in His mercy. And I think that fits much better than the elaborate schemes of source criticism. Now, the word remember, this is the idea of that God took the appropriate personal action on behalf of the one that He remembers. Sometimes it's judgment, most of the time it's blessing. Now the man Noah, of course, the name means rest, and here we have the aftermath of the flood. Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark, and God caused a wind to pass over the earth. Now, Rashi, which is a Middle Ages Jewish commentator, says this was a spirit of compassion. Because the word wind can mean spirit or wind or breath. But I really think what we have here is another example of God using supernatural timing with natural elements. If you notice in verse 2, the reason the flood came, it rained very heavy. The waters of the deep were broken open. Well, the same natural means that caused the flood are the natural means that's going to make the water recede. And so the wind here seems to be a wind for evaporation, for drying, much the same as Exodus 14:21, where God split the waters of the Red Sea, then caused an east wind to blow all night and dry the bottom out. Okay? And the water subsided. It's interesting, this word subsided is the word anger. It's used in Esther chapter 2, verse 1, of the king's anger. And some say, well, that shows that God was angry and now He's not. Well, there is an element of God's wrath here. And there are all kind of connections with these words with some of the Babylonian creation accounts. Was the flood universal? Was it local? And so I want to show you a few books, if I could, that you might want to look a little further in. There is a lot of connections between the account in Genesis, both of creation and of the flood, and what's known as the Babylonian creation account and the Gilgamesh epic. Now, here's a little book on the Babylonian Genesis. There are very similar trends between the two. I think the Babylonian account is a corruption of the biblical account. Okay? And then we have the Gilgamesh epic, and it also has very many parallels in these early parts of Genesis. And you might want to read them and see the parallels. And what will strike you is, although they are similar in many parts as far as technical words and this happening and that happening, sending out a dove and all of that, you'll find a striking difference in the purpose, in the beauty, in the scope, and the power of the narrative. So I think there is a connection, but I really think since the Tower of Babel, men's hearts had been getting further away from the Lord, and the remembrance of these early days was becoming more and more corrupted. I see this same thing in Greek and Roman mythology about the half-gods on Mount Zeus. There's probably a historical current kernel of that, because I think in Genesis 6 that angels did marry human beings or cohabit with them, and the race of the giants came. So I think from these earlier parts of Genesis, there's a corruption in the traditions outside of the nation of Israel, and you might want to see these books. Now I want to mention to you a couple of good books on the flood. Conservative scholars really disagree over, was it universal, was it local? Now, those who want to make it universal are trying to deal with the text and take it literally. Those who say it's local are trying to balance the textual evidence with evidence from archaeology. and anthropology. Now, one that I really like, and you'll like this book, it's Bernard Ram, The Christian View of Science and Scripture. Now, he holds to a local flood, and I think that's fine. I don't agree with that, but he certainly welcomed his opinion. The other one I have is The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris. And this is a very detailed book on the problems of geology and movement of water and fossilization and the flood. Was it universal and all that? They would hold to a universal flood. It's a very technical book, a very complete book. But if you're really interested in this, I think it's important you see it. I want to show you two more books because I think it's such a hassle today between conservative Christianity and modern science. And there shouldn't be, for I don't think Christians have to be afraid of truth. I think God is the author of all truth. So I want to give you two books here that I think if you have a child going to college or if you're interested in the relationship between science and faith, these two books will answer a lot of questions for you. They've really helped me. The first one I want to recommend is The Scientific Enterprise and the Christian Faith by Malcolm Jeeves. You'll really like this. It deals with the scientific method. And here's one, Religion and the Rise of Modern Science by R. Huicos. And I think you'll really enjoy these two as they give a balanced perspective on where Western science developed, how it developed, and the place the Bible plays in that. Remember, the Bible is not an anti-scientific book. It is a pre-scientific book, and these books will help you deal with that. And you need, as a Christian, to be able to articulate your faith in light of modern scientific discovery. Notice it mentions the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. Now, Ararat, there have been two possible locations. One is the mountains of modern Turkey right on the Russian border. But the other one is the mountains in Kyrgyzstan close to Lake Van. It'd be just directly north of the Tigris-Euphrates headwaters. Which it is, I'm not really sure. But notice it says the mountains of Ararat, not the highest peak. And so it came to rest on the mountain range. Now, notice in verse 6 where it mentions, and it came about at the end of 40 days. Now, 40 days in the Bible is usually a long period of indefinite time. But here, because the context is so specific, it's the 10th month and the first day and all of that, we'll probably hear it's a little more specific, okay? That Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. Now, there's a very rare term for window mentioned in chapter 6, verse 16. But this term here is a different term, not the same rare term. We're not exactly sure what this window was, where it was located, how big it was, how it opened. Some think and theorize it was way up under the eave of the ark where Noah could not see very far. It seems like he could see, he would have the answer to his question and wouldn't have to send out birds. Maybe it was way up close to the ark, the top of the ark, under the eaves is why he couldn't see very far. The other thing I want to say to you is be real careful in verses 6 and following about allegorizing the raven and the dove. We tend to do that. That's not the major issue here. There's nothing really significant here. Noah just used a bird to see if it was safe to go out. It shows the patience of Noah. But I don't think we can say, well, this is the Holy Spirit and these are scavengers. I don't think we can do that. Be careful of that. Now, let me go down to verse 20 where it says, Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took every clean animal of every clean bird and offered a burnt offering on the altar. This is the first mention of an altar in the Bible. Although Cain and Abel offered to God, it doesn't mention an altar there. Notice the idea of a clean animal back in chapter 7, verse 2, where it says he took on clean animals on the ark. Now, the trick is we don't know what this means. Does this mean clean and unclean as far as the Mosaic legislation that comes hundreds and hundreds of years later, we find in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. It seems to mean clean and unclean, not in relation to food laws, but in relation to sacrifice. And so we're not real sure of the ancient designation of clean and unclean. Now notice where it mentions here, and the Lord smelled the soothing aroma. Now, this is an anthropomorphic phrase. Notice the word Lord there. It's L, capital O, capital R, capital D. Whenever you see all caps, it's the covenant name Yahweh that we talked about earlier. Now, this simply means the smoke went up from the altar, and the ancients believed the smoke rose to God who was up in the starry heavens. And so it was like it was a symbol of prayers, and so it was God smelt this. Now, in some of the Babylonian creation account, the gods called off the flood because they were hungry. Men hadn't offered sacrifice, and they say that the gods just swarmed around the sacrifice like flies. There's nothing of that mythological thing here. This is a straightforward account, so different from the Babylonian account, and yet tremendous similarities. And so you need to see that. So I think it's anthropomorphic. I don't think God has a nose. It's speaking about the him taking notice of what Noah was doing in faith. The Lord said to himself, now this is the idea of swore to himself. Who does God swear by? Who does God affirm? Who does God talk to? Well, himself. And so here he affirms to himself that he's never going to curse the ground because of man. Now, do not link this curse the ground here with Genesis 3:15. This has nothing to do with Genesis 3. This has to do with the flood. And so the ground is still cursed generally, and man's going to still have to work with the sweat of his brow, and there's still the problem of relationship between men and women. That's all part of that original Genesis 3. This does not affect that. But notice, if you would, where it says, "For the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth." This is an affirmation of what Christian theologians call original sin, or the results of the fall. That not that we're as bad as we can be, but that all aspects of us fail. Our mind, our will, our emotion, our world, everything. Now, the rabbis do not believe in original sin. They go along with the view of the propensities, the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov, the evil and good impulse. But I think this, along with Psalms 51, and especially Romans 5, 12 and following, affirm to me the existence of original sin as a doctrine. I think that's true. Now, in verse 22 and following, notice that God's going to put everything in a pattern, that nature is going to have an orderliness. And this is what Western science is based on. It's called uniformitarianism, that things are happening at the same rate in the same way as they have. And this is the basis. You might as well see the first few verses, I believe it's 1 through 6 of Psalms 19. And that is the basis of Western science, a view in a God who created nature in an orderly way. That's why Western science developed in the West and not in the East, with their more cyclical view of God and theology and nature. Now, chapter 9. And God blessed Noah. Well, that's important. Noah's worried. Everybody's been killed. Everything's died. And Noah's a little antsy, I would imagine, and so is his family. But the Lord blessed Noah. Even with the evil of his own heart, God blessed him. That's a good word for us, because with the evil of our own hearts, aren't you glad God still loves us and makes provision for us in the midst of our sin? Okay. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Now, notice it's the second beginning for man. The same kind of admonition. But notice that the earth is to be subject. We're to subdue it and be subject to us is changed. Also, as a different relationship with the animals. Look at verse 2. The fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast. Wow, how different from the Garden of Eden. How different it's going to be in the eschaton of the last days. You ought to see Isaiah chapter 11, where man and beast will be reunited. But now there's a terror on man. Some have theorized the wild animals would have killed man in his weakness very early, and this gave man a chance to develop, being much less stronger and much less speedy than the animals. I don't know. That's kind of a speculation. Notice it says, with everything that creeps on the ground, all the fish of the sea, into your hands they are given. Man still has domination. And then it says, every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. Notice there is no distinction here between clean and unclean as far as eating. There is as far as sacrifice, but not for eating. Everything was available for man to eat. Now, some have said they had no time to plant and harvest. So this is simply for God's provision for man to eat during this time. All the green plants would have died. I just don't know about that. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. And there we have an example going back to Genesis. Okay? Only you shall not eat flesh with its life that is in its blood. Now here is the major theological truth, this whole passage. This is what it's focusing on. This is what's so significant. Now, I want you to follow with me. There is a distinction in the Old Testament sacrificial system that the life is in the blood. I want to give you a few references, if I could. You might want to see Leviticus 17, 10 through 16, Deuteronomy 12, 16 and 23, Acts 15, 29, I left out one Leviticus one, Leviticus 3, 17. They realized that when they cut themselves, enough of that red stuff ran out, they died. And the ancients began to believe that life was in the blood. And the blood had a very important sacrificial character to it. It's really setting the stage for the sacrificial system. which I believe set the stage for the substitutionary vicarious atonement of Christ. It's only from understanding the sacrificial system that an innocent life had to be shed for sin that we understand the beautiful and radical significance of Jesus, the Lamb of God, without spot or wrinkle or stain or sin, slain from the foundations of the earth for us. It's only in this kindergarten lesson that we learn further the significance of Christ. And I believe that's what we're talking about here. Now, verse 5. And surely I'll require your life blood. Well, this seems to be a penalty for murder. You might want to see Numbers 35:33. From every beast I'll require it. From every man and from every man's brother I'll require the life of man. Now, Maimonides says, refers to suicide and murder. But I really think what it's saying is saying that man is responsible to the society in which he lives. This, to me, is a pretty good Old Testament incipient backdrop to the concept of capital punishment. And I believe that is related in the Bible. In Romans 13:4, it talks about the state does not bear the sword for nothing. And the word there for sword is the short sword the Roman soldiers carried in their belt, and that's what they used to decapitate Roman citizens. So this is true. This is almost an eye for an eye in an Old Testament sense. What it's saying is that man is so precious that whether it's a beast or another man that kills a human being, because it bears the image of God, life will be required at that person's hand. Now, verse 5 is prose, and verse 6 is poetry. Same truth. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. Now, this seems to refer to the Goel, the kinsman redeemer or kinsman avenger, that if one of your family were killed, that person took it on himself to avenge that death. For in the image of God, he made man. Now, what it exactly means by image, we're not sure. Roman Catholic theology makes a lot of distinction between image and likeness in the first few chapters of Genesis. They would say that man's image fell, but man's likeness didn't. They would say the likeness is his rational ability, and the other refers to the superadded gifts of immortality and no pain in that. But I really think that's making too much of a distinction. What we're saying is there is something in us that's like God. I don't think it's a physical image. Maybe it's the ability to relate on an intellectual level. Maybe it's the ability to reason. Maybe the ability to choose. We're just not sure. I'm certain it's the ability to have interpersonal relationships. And so all men are made in God's image. Now look at verse 7. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Here's a specific command to the men, while the other was a specific command to the animals. Okay? Populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. Then God spoke to Noah and told him and his sons, saying, notice that Noah was patient to listen to God's word, and God spoke to him. By the way, I want to mention to you, in verse 7, the rabbis say, because in the context of murder, that couples that intentionally have no children are guilty of murder. Whew, pretty tough exegesis, isn't it? Now behold, verse 9, I myself do establish my covenant with you and your descendants forever. Now you ought to see chapter 6, verse 18. God is reestablishing the covenant. Of all the covenants that I can think of, whether with Adam or with Abraham or with Moses or whatever, this is the only one that is totally unconditional. Nothing is required of Noah in the sense of keeping any rules, performing any task. It's God saying, I'm going to do this. I destroyed all mankind, and I'm not going to do that anymore, and I'm going to make a covenant with you. I won't do that. I think that the human race at this point, those few people left, needed the encouragement that God wasn't going to do this catastrophic judgment again like this that they experienced. And that seems to be the purpose of this. Now, when it says descendants after you forever, this is the Hebrew word olam, and it must be interpreted in light of the passages. It's the same word used in verse 16. Remember the everlasting covenant. Okay, sometimes it means permanent, sometimes for an age or a period, and that seems to be what it is here. And with every living creature that is with you. Now, notice God made the covenant not just with Noah and his family, but with all living creatures. Back in Genesis, the same word nephesh, that's usually translated soul for man, is the same word that's used for the beasts of the field. God loves the animals too. They can't relate to him. They're not his supreme creation. He didn't die to redeem them, but animals seem to be important to God also. Now, notice where, verse 11, and I'll establish my covenant with you, and with all the flesh shall never again be cut off by water of the flood, neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. That's not saying there won't be floods. It's just saying there won't be a catastrophic universal flood to kill all life again. That's what it's saying. Notice it says, with you and all successive generations in verse 12. Now, Rashi says this word is misspelled in the Hebrew text. And because that, it's a sign of only for those who have defective faith. I don't know if I buy that or not. I don't know why it's misspelled, but I don't know if I can put all that emphasis there that he does. Verse 13, I set my bow in the cloud. There have been many historical allusions to Marduk setting his bow in the cloud because he defeated the gods and stuff. But I don't think that kind of mythology should be read in here. And it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. Now, people say, well, is this the first time the rainbow appeared? Well, it seems to me from Genesis 2, 5, and 6 that it didn't rain before this. That God somehow watered the ground from the bottom up or from the mist or from something like that, a dew. And this may have been the first time it rained from clouds and the first time the rainbow would have appeared. That may be true. Verse 15, I will remember my covenant. Notice the sign of the rainbow was not only to encourage man that God wouldn't catastrophically destroy all flesh again, but it was for God, too, to remind him, because I'm sure God's going to get really upset with some of the dumb things that Noah is going to do. Even in this very chapter, he's going to do some dumb things. Man's heart is evil, but God's going to work with him. And that's the promise of the covenant here. Let's see. Look at verse 17. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. You might as well see Isaiah 54, 9 and 10, where this talks about one of the first covenants that God has made with man. Now here come the children. There are three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Okay, Shem means renown or name. Ham means swarthy or dark. And Japheth means the enlarger or the extender. Okay, and Ham was the father of Canaan. Now, the only reason that Canaan is mentioned is because Canaan is somehow involved in Ham's disrespectful act toward Noah. Now, notice here it says, there were three sons, three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. Now, that's what chapter 10 is all about, is going to give the different genealogy list of these three sons, okay? Then Noah began farming and planted a vineyard. Now, it's not that he's the first farmer because Cain was a farmer, but he began farming and he drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself inside his tent. Now, some have said, well, he didn't know that it would make him drunk. It was the first time he had had grapes. There were probably grapes before this. He probably knew what it was. I think there is an element of moral failure on Noah's part. He was in his own tent, granted. The account is so brief, we don't know what happened. Obviously, he became intoxicated, became hot or flush, and took off his clothes for whatever reason. We're not sure. And his son came in and saw him. Notice it says, and Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Now, some have said this is a homosexual act. There's nothing in the text for that. Some have said, well, it was just flagrant disrespect. That seems to be what it is. The word here, gaze, means to gaze intently and take pleasure in. Apparently, he really thought this was funny, the old man had done this. There may have been some bad blood between Noah and Ham. We're not sure all that's involved here. Ham did a rash thing. Noah did a rash thing. The other two sons apparently get the robe that had fallen off of Noah and backed in the tent with that robe on their shoulders and dropped it over their father. I bet the boys didn't tell their daddy about it, but the daddy knew the robe was out of place. And maybe he found out some way. I just don't know. But boy, he was really ticked at this. And Shem and Japheth took a garment, the robe is what, and laid it upon their shoulders and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. I want to say, Bertie, the Bible rails against drunkenness. Man, it just rails. It doesn't say the use of wine is necessarily bad, but it rails against drunkenness. Let me give you a few. Deuteronomy 14:26. Psalms 104:15, Proverbs 31:6-7, Proverbs 23:29-35. Be careful of strong drink. Now, so they covered him up, and it says Noah woke from his wine. He knew, I don't know if he learned by asking or knew by the robe or whatever, that his youngest son, now that's a bad translation. For if you look at the order these sons are listed, Japheth seems to be the youngest. Maybe this seems to mean the dumbest, the most irresponsible, the one who acts the youngest. Maybe it's something like that. And he said, cursed be Cana. Well, why Cana? why Canaan? Ham did it. Well, the rabbis say that Canaan saw it first and went and told his daddy. And maybe that's involved. Maybe Noah saw the tendencies in his son Cana that he disliked so much in Ham. We're just not sure. Now, this has been used to be a proof text that the Negro race is enslaved. Canaan is the father of the Canaanite nations. Cush and Put are thought to be the fathers of the black races, and they're not even mentioned here. They're two other sons of Ham that aren't cursed. Canaan is, so I don't think it can all be used as a proof text by bigots to back up slavery or the subjugation of the black races. It's just not here. Let's see. Notice it says, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem." The minute he says something bad about Ham because of the characteristics of lawlessness and whatever he saw there, he saw something else in Shem, and God's going to use the line of Shem to bring the Messiah. Now, in verse 27, he blesses Japheth. Notice, enlarge Japheth. That's a cognate verb and noun, because the name Japheth means the enlarger. He's going to enlarge the enlarger and let him dwell in the tents of Shem. Now, many have thought this relates to the Gentiles being included in the covenant, and that may be very true. I'm just not sure, but that seems to be possibly what's happening here. Let's see. And Noah lived 350 years after the flood, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Josephus tells us that the reason they lived so long is because they had better food then, and sin hadn't perverted the plant kingdom and hadn't developed better strains of diseases at this time. I just don't really know. Again, I want to say to you, this is a real significant passage coming into chapter 10, because it's going to show us that all human beings have one ancestor, make it Adam or make it Noah, and that we are basically together. This ideal about Shem and Ham and Japheth having a relationship to each other, some in servitude and others in being cooperative help, it maybe is a picture of God's will for all men. The Tower of Babel is where the thing gets split again because of man's sinful arrogance. And I think we need to see that. Here we have a good example of people reading what they want to in the Bible. If you're looking for a proof text to back up your view of slavery, boy, people have proof text this all they want to. But exegesis of this passage will not back that up at all. It simply will not fit. Can't be done. Well, I hope you'll look at these books that I mentioned to you. They'll really help you. I hope you'll buy these that I recommend. I think it's an interesting study. I hope you won't allegorize it too bad. Just take it for what it says, shows Noah's patience, God's promise and provision, God's faithfulness in the midst of man's sin, how sin can corrupt the human race. All of that's here. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place next week. God bless you.